This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. We are The Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar together with Tan Chen Li and Kusu Chuang. It's 7:06 a.m. on Thursday, the 10th of February. In the meantime, though, let's take a recap on how global markets closed yesterday.
Markets did quite well yesterday, actually, in both U.S. and Asian markets. Dow was up 0.9%, S&P 500 up 1.5%, Nasdaq up 2.1%, Asian markets Nikkei up 1.1%, Hang Seng up 2.1%, Shanghai Composite up 0.8%, STI up 0.5%, FBM KLCI up 1.4%.
Ah, so a cheerful mood is permeating global markets.
Green is the new cool color.
Green is the new red? I don't know. Anyways,
could be the Jade Emperor.
Jade, yes. Oh my gosh, the Jade Emperor has blessed the markets after a very raucous birthday yesterday. Anyways, joining us on the line for views on what's moving global markets, we speak to Vishnu Varathan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. Vishnu, good morning. Always good to have you. Now, Asian equity markets have been generally upbeat since the Lunar New Year. What's underscoring this buoyancy?
Good morning. Good to be here. So, as you rightly point out, I think there is going to be some shifts and turns, some opportunities being sought, because we remember at the beginning of the year there's a huge sell-off in markets. So there are opportunity hunters out there who think that the ongoing recovery story, especially with some confidence around the narrative of variant risks being rendered a lot more mild with a resumption in global travel and commerce in view, probably are looking to pick up some of the perceived bargains. So those are some reasons. And if you add on the fact that China is probably going to, have more stimulus coming along its way, those are reasons to be fairly upbeat about the market this time around. But this, of course, comes with the caveat of rising rates in the rest of the world.
Yeah, Vishnu, I want to get into your head a bit, because Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic has actually assuaged investors' concerns about the coming rate hikes, and he has talked about Bostic, about how the economy in America will be able to handle the first round of rate hikes. Why do you think Bostic has chosen to send that narrative into the markets, reading between the lines?
I think he's trying to set context here, and his point being that we are starting from exceptionally low rates. So the first few rate hikes are probably not going to be the proverbial straws that break the camel's back. So I think that's really his point, saying that some rate adjustment and calibration may even be positive insofar that it helps with capital allocation, and if it boosts the efficiency in the economy, it's actually going to boost growth eventually. So I think he's getting markets to be more aligned with the real economy, because one big risk here is the Fed has become a lot more sensitive to financial market conditions. And if you get equity markets selling off very hard on even mild interest rate hikes, then the Fed cannot get on with this job. So it is in the Fed's interest to really assuage this concern.
Yes, that's right. Because in the past, the Fed has actually been very closely aligned with the market movements, and they've been accused, I think, of being very overly market-friendly. So do you get the sense that with the way the markets have reacted negatively to the, to this whole narrative about rates tightening, that any kind of walk back on that narrative will, cause another spike in equity markets? Do you think that's the ultimate goal, do you think?
I think at this juncture, we are, facing a somewhat more nuanced mix of factors. So the one difference this time around compared to the last time when the Fed was much more inclined to keep accommodation in place or to expand it is that this time around, for the first time in over two decades, we actually have got red-hot inflation. And the other side of the coin is that markets do not like sustained elevated inflation either. So I'm not entirely sure that a simple walk back on this is going to boost markets if inflation remains elevated. But of course, the inflation picture is going to change as we get into the middle of the year. And for those reasons, it gets a little trickier to get a grasp on the market. For what it's worth, our own point is that the rate hikes are perhaps not going to be sledgehammers for the markets, whereas the pace and the form of balance sheet runoff by the Fed, that may be something that's a closer watch, given a much tighter correlation between liquidity and how markets perform.
Coming back to Asia, Hong Kong has again tightened what were already some of the world's strictest border controls. What will be the three biggest impact to their economy as a result of these restrictions? Do you see any material impact on the GDP growth this year?
I think GDP growth may have some dampening effect, but we bear in mind that, you know, over the last two decades, Hong Kong's economic outcomes have grown a lot more correlated with China rather than the rest of the world. So the shift has been dramatically towards China. And this zero COVID policy is, of course, to align with China and to keep those channels open. So there is a trade-off involved, and I think it is a considered trade-off, even if it's not an ideal one. And the bigger ramifications come from longer-term views adopted by investors who want to reassess how they look at Hong Kong as a global hub and their, you know, inclinations to remain based there. I think those are probably going to be the biggest and the longest-reaching effects of it, whereas the border closures are an inconvenience, and of course, I'm not understating that, but that's probably not going to be the death knell for the economy.
Mm. And you mentioned zero COVID, China's zero COVID policy, Vishnu. Due to supply bottlenecks as a result of this policy, the Asia-Pacific countries have regionally begun integrating their supply chains to a greater extent last year. Can intra-regional links totally obviate the risk of exposure to China?
And that's a good question, and perhaps one that gets a lot more interesting if we take a 20 to 30 year horizon on this. If you're taking a 5 to 10 year horizon, then incrementally, of course, we get greater buffer from supply shocks that emanate from China, but we cannot be completely insulated from it, given China's sheer scale and the depth of its supply chain. So for those reasons, we think it's a case of mitigation, not elimination of risk.
Yeah, Vishnu, on that point as well, because China's got this vigorous zero COVID policy, it's cut itself off from the rest of the region, and in a way, ASEAN, which has in the past really relied on China for a lot of trade, there's a lot of discussion about the bloc being a force to be reckoned with in the years ahead. Do you see that integration having accelerated because of COVID in the last 2 years?
I think COVID really leans into that case. But we already saw the foundations and the much stronger foundations of this being laid down by the U.S.-China trade tensions that really brought to the fore the necessity for a lot of manufacturers and investors to look outside of China. And more importantly, I think where COVID has come in is that, and this is a good and a bad thing, it has created the mindset that, you know, just-in-time inventory management or sometimes even the necessity for excess capacity, duplication, and considered redundancy, deliberate redundancy in manufacturing capacity and capital. I think that has become something that now manufacturers consider quite, carefully and perhaps take much greater importance. The downside to this, so the upside is that we get resilience. The downside is that, of course, this is going to add to costs. And so these are things that we need to grapple with in terms of the way we look structurally at the manufacturing ecosystem.
Coming back to Southeast Asia, what is your view on the Bank of Thailand's decision yesterday to keep the rates on hold, the interest rates?
I think we can, in an interesting way, link this back to China. And we can say, look, ASEAN as a whole has recovered quite well, but there's been a greater degree of differentiation. And the economies that are a lot more tourism dependent, like Thailand at the top of this, the most extreme end of the spectrum, have been harder hit by zero COVID policies and snakes and ladders type of restrictions and easing off. So for those reasons, I think Thailand has quite rightly determined that its core inflation remains low enough, whereas growth has not, recovered in a even enough fashion with a lot of weak linkages for them to keep on hold. So the narrative of ASEAN for being in a position to have a little bit more patience on tightening despite hawkish signals from the Fed, I think that has got some currency to it, no pun intended, and really how FX markets move will also factor into their decision.
Vishnu, thanks very much for speaking to us this morning. That was Vishnu Varathan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank, talking to us about some of the trends that he sees moving markets, saying that ASEAN central banks have patience in tightening
Yeah, that's right. I just want to talk about a party I went to a couple nights ago, and you know, the individuals that were at this party work in China. They work in electronics and you know, US and Malaysian companies in China. They were telling me that in the last 2 years, China has developed to an extent that is really beyond recognition. And, you know, they went to work in China 10 years ago, and China 10 years ago and China today is totally off the scale in terms of advancement, in terms of payments, in terms of everything, right? But I also want to juxtapose that, because we rely a lot on China for trade and economy, right? China has reintroduced its ended its restriction on single child families, right?
That's right.
Because the working age population and birth rates are so low in the last few years. China by 2100, I read research, right? China by 2100 will have fewer people than India and fewer people than Nigeria by the end of the century. And that's going to be very interesting.
I think that's what George Soros said something last week, where he said that President Xi Jinping may not be re-elected this year because of three reasons. And birth rate is one of the reasons that he quoted.
Yeah.
So definitely a trend that we're going to keep watching on. Whatever happens to China has vast repercussions on the rest of us. I want to come back to something that Vishnu mentioned about the optimism that global markets are feeling because of perhaps milder Omicron wave or effects of the Omicron variant. And we can see that in the earnings that have come out overnight. So starting with Disney, Disney reported its first quarter earnings that beat analyst estimates on higher earnings per share and revenue. Revenue for the quarter increased by 34%. On year to $21 billion, while adjusted earnings per share is at $1.06. That's 45 cents higher than analyst expectations.
And net income was, from continuing operation is at $1.1 billion, which is a vast improvement from the $29 million recorded a year ago. I think mainly it's because Disney Plus added 11.8 million new subscribers into the quarter, which brings the total subscription to 129.8 million. So which is exceeding all the expectation of 126 million total subscriptions.
Yeah, but 130 million paying subscribers, that's 38% higher from a year ago, okay? And that is really causing, you know, Netflix executives to really wring their hands in despair. The thing is, Disney Plus customers pay less than half of what Netflix customers pay. That's the first thing, right? But the interesting thing is that India has 46 million subscribers of Disney Plus. That's more than America and Canada's 43 million subscribers. So read into that what you will. Maybe they like the kind of animations that Disney produces. But, you know, for what it's worth, it's interesting because they're getting real traction in a subcontinent that has got 1.2 billion people.
That is an interesting nugget right there.
Yeah.
And if we look at their parks, Disney's parks, their revenue has doubled year on year to $7.2 billion. I mean, indicative of just the opening that's happening. Yeah, they're seeing more guests at theme parks, more guests going to Disney hotels and booked on cruises. So operating results actually jumped $2.5 billion compared to a loss of $100 million years ago. So they are operating on a low base, right? They did really badly last year, so any improvement this year is going to look great. But yeah, this is indicative of just the, where optimism is at the moment.
Yeah, and this is like a high-performance car, isn't it? They've got twin turbochargers, right? One on the subscriber streaming front, the other one on the parks. They've also talked to Bob Chapek, the chief executive of Disney, that they'll pass Netflix by the year 2024 in terms of paying subscribers. Today, Netflix has 224 million subscribers. By 2024, Disney will have 230 million subscribers.
That's really not that far off.
It's not that far off, yeah.
Netflix must be shaking in their boots.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.